Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG for short, a housing group for older people run by old people. Present
Raise the Roof!
We advocate for secure, affordable and appropriate housing. So listen up on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30pm on 3CR 855 on your AM dial.
That's right. You're listening to Raise the Roof, the Housing for the Aged Action Group show here on 3CR, 8:55am. My name's Shane. I'm here with Fiona. How you doing, Fiona?
Hey, Shane.
How was your holiday?
It was awesome, but I'm back now.
Well, that was a great story. Moving on. We've got quite a bit to get through today. So Liz and I recently spoke to Trish Quabell, who's the CEO of Primary Care Connect, which is a service or a set of services in the Greater Shepparton, Moira, Murrindindi, Mitchell and Strathbogie Shires, delivering a range of health services. I'm explaining that very badly. She'll do a much better job than I have. So we'll go to the interview now and hear what she had to say. In particular, not just about health services, but about how that connects to housing and climate change and severe weather events. Welcome, Trish. To start with, can you tell us a bit about what Primary Care Connect is and what it does?
Thanks, Shane. Primary Care Connect is one of the 22 independent community health services across Victoria. There are a number of us scattered across regional and rural Victoria as well. So Primary Care Connect, we service the local government areas of Greater Shepparton, Strathbogie and Moira Shires, and also down into the Mitchell and Murrindindi areas as well.
And what sort of services are you providing for people?
So community health often sort of spreads between health and community services, as the name probably suggests. So we run a number of services from family violence, alcohol and other drugs, gamblers help. In Shepparton and Moira Shire, we have large refugee communities, so we have a significant refugee trauma and torture programs as well. And we also run a number of programs in the health sector, so we have our physiotherapists, dietitians, dietetics, diabetes educator, and we run a number of gym programs and nursing programs as well across our outreach area. And one of our newer programs, which is seeing great impact and really influenced my thoughts around what we're talking about today, is our community paramedic program, our CPAT program, which actually actively goes out into our more isolated communities and holds chronic conditions workshops and clinics to be able to support community members to have a health check, get some additional education on their chronic conditions quite often.
I'm just going to have to interrupt a moment. Sorry, the recording is... So, Trish, you just mentioned the community paramedic service. And so recently I heard you talk at the launch of a new VCOS report that's called Adaptation for All, which is about inequality during extreme weather. So can you tell us how the community paramedics supports people during extreme weather?
So our CPAT team do a regular rotation of clinics into our outlying communities and to a number of spaces where vulnerable community members may congregate. So, for instance, we partner with neighbourhood houses on days when they might be running a community luncheon, which are often attended by community members who have issues of vulnerability or disadvantage and are really feeling the cost of living pressures at the moment, particularly around food, fresh food, but also around, we're finding what they're doing is they're often making those really difficult choices, particularly in hot and cold. And, you know, we've had some very cold winter mornings up here in Shepparton recently with very crusty lawns with the ice and whatnot. But what we find is that people are making those choices between heating and actually being able to go to a doctor, particularly when we're in an environment where we have a real lack of bulk billing clinics quite often in rural and remote areas. And when people are having to make those difficult choices, they become much more at risk of making choices that put their health at risk. So one of the examples we found is that our paramedic and community development worker was out working with a community group, and they were talking to a woman out there who had been finding that her diabetes was feeling quite out of control. Now, she was on diabetes medication. She was on a long release form of the medication. She'd started breaking her tablets in half and only taking a half dose, thinking that it was a slow release so it would still be fine and she could stretch out before she had to make the choice to go and buy her next round of medication. By breaking the seal on the medication, she was getting a high hit at one point in the morning and it was no longer a long-lasting effect. So she was in fact disadvantaging and putting at risk her health because she was having to make those hard choices between heating her house and actually the cost of going to a doctor to get a prescription redone and then to go and actually fill that script as well. Even with government benefits, it's becoming more and more difficult for a number of people and they're having to make those difficult choices.
It's really interesting to talk to someone who has a health lens on these sorts of issues, because we've talked about the sort of connection between severe weather events, heat waves especially, and housing before. But hearing you talk about it from a perspective of a health organisation is a sort of different approach, but is really interesting to me.
Oh, thank you. And yet we would agree with you completely. It is. We often talk about climate adaptability, as a whole of community example. And when we do extreme weather events or natural disasters, such as the 2022 floods that we had in Shepparton, for instance, we think about them as more on a whole of community approach. And it's unfortunately at that very high level, it's easy to lose focus on the individual ability to adapt to their change, the change that's needed. And some of the difficult challenges they have to decide which direction they're going to go. Are they going to buy petrol or are they going to go buy fresh groceries? Are they going to go to the doctor because their diabetes hasn't been attended to or they need blood pressure medication? Or are they going to heat their home or cool their home? And I think the research that VCOS has done and the amazing work that Juanita Pope and her team down there with Julianne Tice, who have been looking into this climate adaptability, have really, their most recent report, as you said, really focuses down on not just the high-level community but the individual within that community and how, for instance, you know, our migrant populations, I think it was 2.3 times more likely to be at higher levels of vulnerability with climate adaptability because they don't have the capacity to make those changes individually or they're severely limited in those abilities.
And Tricia, what are you and your organisation seeing in terms of people's housing circumstances and how they're living and how that might be impacting on their health and then what the implications are for that during extreme weather?
I think what we're finding is that in addition to the cost of heating and cooling homes, is that often, for instance, our migrant and refugee populations are living in multi-generational groups and often in poor housing circumstances because of what they can actually access in terms of rental accommodation. There are limitations in terms of the ability or the willingness for some landlords to install good heating and cooling. And if houses are old and drafty, that ability to actually, very limited budgets, for instance, for our ageing population, who are more and more becoming very dependent on their pensions, the ability to make change and to sort of, you know, for instance, put in additional insulation becomes more and more constrained because people who are living on limited incomes don't have the ability to make the choice to purchase those other products or services that will then make it make their adaptation easier.
And I think at the VCOS launch, there was some talk about people who were living in caravans and sleeping rough in rural areas and how that can increase someone's vulnerability as well.
Absolutely. I think in talking to our other agencies around town, such as Food Share, we're seeing higher than ever demand by community members who are in vulnerable housing or sleeping rough to access the support services that can provide them with food, accommodation, and just the basics of living. So as those services become more and more in demand across the state, and particularly in rural and regional areas where there's not as many services to provide those supports, we're finding that pressure of upstream investment is very difficult to find. So what we find is that there is such a pressure on the reactive nature of responding, particularly in the health services. So we see a lot of investment in acute health services, but in order to stem the tide of people going into acute health services or acute response requirements, we need to put some investment upstream so that we're doing preventative care and preventative support within our community to actually allow people to make choices that aren't as extreme for their own health and their own living conditions.
So you talked a little about things that communities can do to address some of these issues. Could you talk a bit about what things that we can do as sort of service providers or maybe at the government level to address some of these impacts?
At the government level, I think there was some great actions that were put out that were suggested by VCOP in their report. Things, for instance, such as create and fund an office of the Commissioner for the Wellbeing of Future Generations. I think that's it's a big picture thing, but what it will do is will actually support us looking forward in that upstream investment strategy that I was talking about, to not just think in the moment that we're in right here and now. Increased funding for community services. I know everyone says we need more. Everyone will always say we need more money. But at the moment, still most of our services are funded in a reactive space. So you have to be experiencing an issue before you're able to access a service. So community services and our Aboriginal community controlled organisations often feel quite constrained in the preventative work that we can do for our community, and the ability to actually support the rollout of new and innovative programs with great evaluation around them in longer term. We often see pilot programs that roll out for 1 or 2 years. We're talking about being able to support community with generational change. And obviously generational change does not change within a 1 or 2 or 3 year funding window as well. I think a lot of us, as I was talking about before, people in community, individuals or families in community that have the financial means are often able to purchase into or buy into government schemes around electrification or energy efficiency upgrades or solar. Unfortunately, the communities that we're often dealing with don't have the ability to buy into, even at discounted rates, those energy efficiency and solar rebate opportunities that government offers. So the ability to expand those services to either public housing or low income, where it's not necessarily at the behest of a landlord, will provide support for additional community members to make the choice to adapt their living experience and be able to address climate extremes more in a healthier way, for instance. But I think there's no one answer to this, and I think the report by VCOS actually points out a number of different opportunities that can support this transformative change that would allow us to move beyond the large big picture policy changes to individual adaptation ability as well.
Yeah, so things around the energy efficiency upgrades for low-income residents and those energy efficiency upgrades not being reliant on individual home ownership. So many rentals have very kind of low-quality insulation and ability to heat and cool and things like that, quite problematic.
Yeah, no, exactly right, Liz. We can never underestimate the vulnerability that comes with that poor housing stock and what is actually available. We know that rental accommodation in Victoria is under a very significant pressure point at the moment. It's incredibly difficult to find rental accommodation, particularly in our rural and regional areas as well. And the ability to make small changes even to stop drafts and some of the ability to engage with the heating that we need or the cooling that we need in summer, because we do swing from one extreme to the other. You know, the ability to strengthen our Victorian housing stock through targeted upgrades and support to low-income housing and to invest in equity-centred actions are a huge opportunity for the Victorian government.
Well, that's probably a good note to leave on. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch if they are interested in some of the services that you provide? Or
absolutely. If you are in the Primary Care Connect service area, which is, again, the City of Greater Shepparton, Moira, Strathbogie, and some of our services also go down into the Mitchell and Murrindindi area, the best way to contact us is to either look at our website, which is www.primarycareconnect.com.au, or our direct line is 58233200. If you are in other areas of Victoria, as I said, there are 22 registered independent community health services who offer a range of services across their communities. So if you simply did a search on the web for community health service near me, I'm sure one of my colleagues or services will come up, and they'd be more than happy to help you out with any issues.
Thank you very much, Trish, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was Trish Quibell from the Primary Care Connect. We're going to hear some community service announcements. You're listening to 3CR, 8:55 a.m. I got those things all in the wrong order, but it was close enough. So here are your community service announcements.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you are currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
This is Irene Bolger, former Secretary of the Nurses Federation in Victoria. Throughout the nurses dispute in 1986 and the waterfront dispute in 1998, 3CR was always there, broadcasting the voices of workers in struggle.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, and we're broadcasting live from the Bay to Chicken Strike here in Melbourne.
We've just seen all of the thousands of nurses walk through to their meeting and people from different unions showing their solidarity.
3CR, radio for the workers, by the workers, since 1976.
So, Fiona, we mentioned before that you're just back from holiday. You came basically right back from your holiday straight into Parliament House. Is that right? Is that where it was?
Yeah. On my first day, I was called to give evidence into the parliamentary inquiry into the decision to demolish and redevelop the high-rises. So that was last Tuesday. I don't know if we haven't really talked much about this, but the inquiry is taking place at the moment. I think all of the public hearings have finished, and it also called for submissions, and they received over 800 submissions, lots from public housing tenants as well, about the implications and the effect of the decision on them and their housing and the uncertainty that has been occurring around that decision. So, yeah. That's what happened on Tuesday. We were asked to give evidence.
What sort of evidence did you give?
I basically gave similar evidence to what was in our submission, which is that we're really concerned about the effect of the decision on older tenants. So listeners are probably aware that some of the high rises are actually dedicated for older people's housing. They're 55 plus housing towers. There's about 12 of them. And we're concerned, particularly for some of the residents that are in their 80s and 90s, that they may not survive the move. There's a big question which has been coming up a lot about whether or not there's any possibility for refurbishment or renewal without having to demolish the towers. But we don't really have a strong opinion on that because we don't really know enough about it. And a lot of the stuff that we saw in the inquiry was around, where's the evidence for this? Show us the, and particularly to the Minister and Homes Victoria, where's the reports that demonstrate that this is needed? So Our concern, again, is with the older tenants, both in the 55-plus towers and also in the general public housing towers, because the effect of moving in older age is kind of well known. But also what's going to happen after this demolition occurs. So we haven't heard any announcements or any guarantees that there's going to be any public housing rebuilt on any of these sites. We know that there's going to be a minimum of a 10% increase in social housing, but as far as we've been told and as far as we is publicly aware, all of that will be community housing, not public housing. And there'll be a threefold increase in the density of that housing on those sites too, but the majority of that will be private housing, which of course is a major concern for HAG. We want to see 100% of housing built on public land being public housing.
Well, why is that? Like, why does the government want to build private housing on public land?
It's a really good question, and I don't think we have the answer to it. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the minister appeared the following day, and I believe that those videos will be online if people haven't seen it, but both Homes Victoria and the minister didn't provide the information as to why the decision was made, and same with the Supreme Court. So apparently this is an Attorney General decision, and the Supreme Court also, when the hearing was taking place on the class action that tenants brought, those documents haven't been made public. So we don't actually know the reason why. But our view is that public housing is the most appropriate form of housing for older people because the rents are capped at 25% of the income and they can stay there as long as they need to, and there's protections in place through the Victorian Ombudsman. And, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff there that we think needs to be maintained in public hands.
Don't we all just sort of think that Daniel Andrews came up with it on his own and just dumped it on everyone, and now they're unwilling to admit that nobody thought this through?
I don't know. I mean, it's pretty clear from the evidence that it was not rolled out in a particularly, you know, well thought out way. Like, there was lots of tenants giving evidence that they found out about it through a flyer through under the door, and that, you know, even housing workers found out on the same day as the tenants, apparently, in some cases. So it does seem to have been a little bit rushed, and there's certainly some things that they could be doing better, like, without a doubt. The whole relocation process itself, it doesn't seem as though many lessons have been learnt from the low rises where they've already done this either. There seems to be a lot of pressure being applied, and it's just, yeah, some of the evidence that's come out, it's definitely worth having a listen to. And I think that's probably the main value of this inquiry, is that it has given a platform for tenants to have their say and to be listened, well, to have the opportunity to be heard. Whether or not that actually affects policy remains to be seen.
Well, yeah, so we'll talk about the outcomes, but so who, you mentioned some tenants, but who else was speaking at the inquiry?
So on the day that we were there, there was members of, and a lot of these people have been on Raise the Roof, so you would be very familiar some of the names. You heard it here first. So Office, the not-for-profit architect firm that has come up with different refurbishment studies, including for Barak Beacon and for Ascot Vale Estates, and now the high-rises as well. There was the Law Institute of Victoria. There was the Centre for Urban Research, David Kelly and Libby Porter, who we've had on the show before. There was the Safe Public Housing Collective. There was the Renters and Housing Union. Also, the following day, there was Tenants Victoria and the Victorian Public Tenants Association, as well as the community housing industry. And the afternoon was basically devoted to Homes Victoria and the Minister.
And so what are the next steps, or what are the outcomes we can expect from an inquiry like this?
Well, normally what happens with inquiries is that they put out a report with recommendations, and the government has a time limit in which to respond to those, and they can choose to accept or reject the recommendations of the inquiry. We certainly saw with the people, long-term listeners will remember that about 10 years ago we had a similar inquiry into retirement housing. And there was a range of recommendations, some of which were adopted or supported by government, a lot that weren't. And only now, 10 years later, are we starting to see some of those things get put in place. And they're things like a review of the Retirement Villages Act and stuff. So these things take a really long time, and there's no guarantee of any actual change. But I'm really hoping that the decision makers listen to some of the views of the tenants and their experience and try to put some things in place to improve the way that they've been treated.
Yeah, I guess the other development that is significant in terms of what the government might do is that there've been quite effective community pickets at the redevelopment sites in Flemington recently over the last few weeks that has certainly impeded and slowed down the work, which will drive up costs for the government in, you know, continuing to pursue these sort of policies. So you would hope that that sort of combination of direct action, community pressure and, you know, the sort of formal processes of government inquiry can, I don't know, synchronise somehow to improve outcomes for renters and to keep more public housing in public hands.
Yeah, we definitely want to see more public housing being built. And we've got these parcels of land, inner city land, in exactly the places where people want to live that could have the potential to be housing, you know, at least making a bit of a dent in the public wait list. But, yeah, it's who knows what's going to happen.
All right. So if people want to find out more about public housing campaigns and HAG's policy work, one great way that they can find out more and get fed is to come to our August General Meeting.
Yeah.
Fiona, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the August General Meeting?
So next Thursday, the 21st of August at 11 o'clock, we are having one of our four general meetings that we have a year. This one is our winter soup meeting, which is when staff make beautiful soup and share it with our members. And we're also using it as an opportunity to showcase our regional work. So the interview that you heard from earlier is a result, well, is in the same area that we have some housing workers funded through philanthropy who are doing a fantastic job of finding people who may not know that they're eligible for assistance and may not know where to go for help, and they've managed to house 100 people so far. So we'll be celebrating that amazing milestone. We'll be showing a film, a very short film about the regional project, and we'll be sharing soup with members. So come along.
Awesome. So if you would like to RSVP for that, you can do it through our website, which is oldertenants.org.au, or you can give us a call on 9654 7389. That's 9654 7389. Or if you're an older Victorian who'd like to get in touch because you've got a housing issue you'd like some advice or assistance with, you can call us on 1300 765 178. That's 1300 765 178. Fiona, any last words for your first show back?
Well, I should just say, when I said members sharing soup, I also mean supporters. So if you're not actually a HAG member and you want to come along, you are most welcome to, and maybe you can consider becoming a HAG member.
And we'll let you have soup regardless. So I'm going to leave you with a song. We're almost out of time. I found this on the 3CR server. I've never heard of it before. I tried Googling to find out more about the origin of this, but I didn't find anything. But we're going to hear a song by the International Gay Society. This is called Stand Up For Your Rights. Enjoy. See you next time.
Stand up. Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Don't need nobody trying to run our life.
We got rights.
We gotta keep on fighting.
We got rights.
And we shouldn't have to.
We got rights.
We got rights, yeah.
We got to fight.
Ooh, yeah. All right. What I say. America, this is my country. I don't need nobody telling me how to lead my life.
We got rights.
Got the same rights as every citizen. We got to fight for.
We got rights.
We got rights, yes we have.
We got to fight
for our free time.